Good evening, everybody. It's John Windover here yet again for an Inspirability talk, all in aid of Airability. It's been a few weeks since we've come together for these unique insights into those in aviation that we've seen on the silver screen or aspire to be, doing what they do in our world of aviation. And, this evening, we've got a real special guest. Before I get to that, I just wanted to let everybody know that these Inspirability talks are available to be downloaded as a podcast off Spotify or Apple Music. So you can listen to these at your leisure. It doesn't have to be live, but please, if you are watching live this evening, do like, comment and share. Now, I would like to focus on the word comment because part of our talk this evening will actually be a competition. And it's a competition to win a book by the author who will be joining me on screen very shortly. That author is John Nicol. Now, many of you will know the name because John is a prominent publisher, actually, and has also been on the TV with lots of documentaries and also providing expert insights for the news channels about the exploits of what he got up to with his colleagues in Gulf War One, but also about aviation in general. John Nicol joined the Royal Air Force and served a career of 15 years and started off as a technician before getting a commission and becoming a navigator on the Tornado Force. Now, of course, the Tornado Force provided air defence and also ground attack, and John served on many missions, both operationally and in peacetime. Most notably, of course, if those of you who know of John's career in the first Gulf War, but John also served in the Balkans and also represented the Royal Air Force in the Falkland Islands, the US and Norway. Now, John was shot down during the first Gulf War on the first daylight low-level mission raid of the war. And some of you may remember the Tornado Down book and documentary that was published at the time. And John has taken his interest of aviation beyond his Royal Air Force career and is a notable publisher, best probably known for the Tornado Down book, but he's written 5 novels and 9 World War II history books. But his latest piece of work is this here. It's called Tornado in the Eye of the Storm. And I've just read this book and it is absolutely brilliant. I struggled to put the thing down. I've got in trouble at home for, not carrying out my domestic duties because I've been following the stories in this book and it really is incredible. And we're going to talk about that book this evening. And we're also going to learn a bit about the Tornado and what it got up to during the first Gulf War. But John is also on the After Dinner Speaker circuit. He does motivational speeches and has been a commentator and presenter for the BBC, GMTV, CNN, again, bringing that aviation expertise to all of us. So without further ado, I'd like to bring John onto the screen.
John, hello, John. Thank you very much. Thank you for that very kind invitation. I'll send the tenner in the post to you for seeing the book. Thank you very much.
Well, we can see your we can see your career behind you as well as me having wished it past you in the last few minutes there. But John, tell us where you are. Where's home for you?
I live in Hertfordshire, northeast corner of the M25. I ended up down here. I left the Air Force, gosh, 96, I think it was. And kind of looking for somewhere to live. Yeah. Came here, kind of, I'm in and out of London quite a lot. My wife works in London, so it's a convenient place to be. And we're lucky, it's a nice part of the country.
It is, no, very much so. Very accessible as well, of course, central England. Now, John, let's turn straight to the book. It probably feels like it was inevitable, but what really motivated you, John, to bring this book together? And when did that idea come about?
Last year. I mean, this was a very quick process, this one. So I wrote Lancaster. Where's that? Over there. There. Last year. That came out last year, Father's Day last year. And I was looking for another subject. And I'd been chatting a few months before to some of my old RAF mates who were prisoners of war with me. And my wife said, we are having our annual reunion, my wife said, you speak to those people in a way that you don't speak to anybody else. And it was true, because we shared something. And it was the same when we got together for our tornado reunions. There's a big tornado reunion. And I just thought, you know what? None of my mates have really told their story. And so I knew some of the story. But when I started speaking to people I've been friends with for 30 plus years, I couldn't believe what they'd gone through during the Gulf War. And I didn't know their story. And so I thought, that's it. You know, that's what I want to do. I want to record the story of the Tornado Force during that first Gulf War. It was pivotal. It was pivotal for the Royal Air Force. It was pivotal for the Tornado and for the world, because what was put in place and what set off 30 years ago still has ramifications today, in actual fact.
Yeah, quite, absolutely. And you know, just looking at the Tornado itself, it's my age, it's 46, although it's retired. Maybe that's a hint for me to think about that. It really has served the Royal Air Force and this country incredibly well. Of course, it's an aircraft that if I'm not mistaken, John, you know, you stayed on throughout your Royal Air Force flying career. And you know, we've seen it at air shows. The great British public don't see it as a weapon of war, do they? They don't really see it until the Gulf War, the first, you know, major war that was televised, and the biggest conflict since World War II. I mean, the statistics are incredible. 100,000 sorties flown by the coalition, 90,000 tons of bombs dropped. I mean, it really was a major part of our history nationally, wasn't it? This campaign, which you were involved with.
Very much so. You know, first of all, so I served on the GR1 and the F3, so the ground attack and the air defence variant. And before the Gulf War, I certainly didn't think that the Tornado would ever be used in any mass military action. In the 1980s, the Tornado was a Cold War aircraft. It was a Cold War bomber. You know, we had two main roles. The first one was to hold back the Soviet advance through Eastern Germany, when there was East and West Germany, until the Americans could get across the pond if the Cold War ever turned hot. And we thought that might last kind of 2 or 3 days. And then if we couldn't do that, resorting to nuclear weapons to end that section of the conflict. And so for me, and I think most people on the Tornado, the notion of taking it into battle in any mass sense was simply far from our minds, or, you know, most people said that. And so when it all kicked off, it was a huge, huge shock, a huge surprise, but we wanted to go. We wanted to be part of it, not because we were warmongers. We wanted to go because we had been like firefighters who'd never been to a blaze. We'd been like paramedics that had never been to a road crash. And this was going to be our opportunity to put our training to the test. It's different now for young men and women joining up. They know that they'll see action. Back then, we just didn't see it in that way.
Mm-hmm. And you know, obviously there was a political event, an act of aggression that occurred from one state onto another. Saddam Hussein, you know, invaded Kuwait for the reasons that we all know. Perhaps you could reappraise us of those reasons, or at least his reasons for doing so. Yeah. But it must have felt like a far off act of aggression. At that time, did you begin to think we could be involved here?
I didn't. I mean, again, one of the stories that I tell in the book is Robbie Stewart, a friend of mine who flew with Dave Waddington. Robbie remembers seeing the headline Saddam's forces invaded Kuwait on the 4th of August, 1990. And so I think the headline, 5th, 6th, big banner headline, Saddam invades Kuwait. And he said he knew then. He knew that they would be involved. And I certainly didn't feel that. Even when we were told that we'd be going, I thought it would be a saber rattling exercise, that the politicians, the diplomats would sort it out. Some people did think that it would end in a conflict, but I didn't. But it was again, you know, you have to cast your mind back, well, 31 years now to August 1990. The world came together then. It wasn't people, it wasn't like the second Gulf War or Afghanistan where there was all the arguments that happened. The world came together to say, you to Iraq, you must leave Kuwait. Now, I'm not naive. If Kuwait did exported bananas instead of oil, I don't think we would have gone there. If Kuwait didn't border Saudi Arabia and the West supplies of oil, we probably wouldn't have gone there. But it was an illegal act of aggression, and the brutality shown to the Kuwaiti people was appalling. I know that you can cite other instances where we didn't do anything, but in that, the world came together and said, up with this, we will not put. And that's how a million of us found ourselves sitting out in the region, kind of, you know, in January 1991.
Yeah. Now, we called it Operation Granby, the Americans' Desert Storm. You know, this was a huge, huge mobilization of a coalition force, you know, that's probably certainly prior, well, since the Second World War, and perhaps for many more years to come, a force that was absolutely huge. The Tornado Force clearly kept a keen eye on this as matters, you know, progressed. When did you start to take this seriously, John, and your buddies on the squadron?
I think at different times. We were told in the August that we would be going, and then in true military style, kind of thing, different things happened and a different squadron went. And then we were told, I think, kind of in the September, we would be going in a couple of months' time. And so we went out in the end of November, beginning of December. And even when we got out then, we were training hard, really kind of pushing the jet to its and ourselves to its limits. I still didn't think it would happen. And I didn't think it would happen until the very last minute. I truly believed the politicians would sort it out. Others who were planning the mission, completely unbeknown to me, you know, as a junior bod on the squadron, I didn't know any of this was going on. But some of the senior people were planning each mission. They certainly thought it would happen. But for me, I guess I might have been naive. I didn't know. I didn't really think it would happen until the moment it happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I remember watching the build up on TV. I mean, you know, they called it the Top Gun generation. Those who are perhaps a little bit older than I, that, you know, found their calling to join the Air Force. Perhaps it was the Gulf War that many more found it their calling to want to join the Air Force and represent their country, because it really did feel like a very just war. Regardless of your political persuasion, it felt the right thing to do. And, you know, every opportunity was provided, of course, you know, to find a peaceful settlement. But there you were, you found yourself in the desert. Tell us about the workup and the training, because obviously, you know, for your entire career, you trained for something else, or at least a different enemy. And now you find yourself in a different theater, a different part of the world, perhaps using the same method and tactics, but for somewhere completely different.
I think, it's quite an interesting point, John, because it wasn't different. The thing that was different about the experience was the environment. So living and working in a desert location. Now, in typical Air Force style, we weren't living in the desert. Bloody hell. We were living in Bahrain in the Sheraton Hotel. You know, and so it was, as an experience of deployment, it wasn't bad. My mates who were over at Tabuk in a very sparse base had a very different experience. And obviously the troops out in the desert, literal desert, had a completely different experience. But on the training side, we were doing what we'd always trained to do, which was utilize the Tornado's incredible tactics of ultra low level flying at night under the radar, using terrain following radar and attacking airfields. That's what we were trained to do. And so that wasn't a surprise. We did exactly what we'd been trained to do. And we had trained with Soviet tactics. And that is mainly what the Iraqis had. Their integrated air defense system was a more or less Soviet designed integrated air defense system. Their missile systems, the SAM-2, the SAM-3, the SAM-6, the SAM-8, were all Soviet systems that we knew and had practiced against, whether it was in Red Flag in Las Vegas or up in Otterburn at the Rangers. We trained against all of them. Their jets, the MiG-29, we were, you know, that was for one of us. For us, that was one of our greatest fears, a really ultra-modern Soviet fighter that, you know, the Tornado, for all of its skills, we did not want to get mixed up with a MiG-29 coming in on our tail or something like that. So all of those things were what we trained to do. When we were out in the Gulf training, the basic restrictions had gone out of the window. So we were flying, or the pilots were flying, the jets daytime down to 30 feet, I would imagine, something like that. And kind of, well, depending on which stage of the mission, kind of 500, 540, 560 knots. So in layman's terms, 640 plus miles an hour at 30 feet. Nighttime, we were flying multiple parallel track nighttime. So 8 jets go flying through the night in total darkness, no lights on. This is an era before global positioning, what other people might call sat-nav. This was inertial navigation systems in the jet. That's all we had. No night vision goggles. Although some were kicking around, the jet was not compatible with night vision goggles, and neither was the ejection system, which was really important. So we were using the jet at the edge of its wartime capability. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. Now, John, you mentioned the enemy. What did you know of your enemy? I mean, what could you do to best prepare yourself for what you thought you might come up against?
Well, we knew all of their systems. And so the radar systems, we were constantly practicing tactics against surface-to-air missile systems, constantly practicing tactics against fighters. So we would get either some of our own jets, of our own fighters, maybe the F-3s, who are based in Saudi. We would regularly come up against Americans off F-18s, F-16s, F-15s out of Saudi, F-14s off the carriers. We would arrange full wartime practice missions with them. So, you know, you wouldn't just have 8 Tornadoes. You might have, you know, kind of a large training package of aircraft, air-to-air refueling, fighter support, defense suppression support. Nothing like it was on night one, let me tell you that. But that's your training as close to the edge as you can, so that when it happens for real, you're not shocked. We were shocked.
Yeah. Now, there's a great photograph there, John, of the Tornado in its natural habitat, low level, I can see there. Now, there's a couple of questions. I'm just going to hit the
ball. I'll tell you what, just before you do, this is worth pointing out. Yeah. So that is a fully armed Tornado out of Marham, and I think that was 1989. And so that jet has got 2 JP233s on. It's fully loaded. It's got the chaff and flare pod is loaded. The guns are loaded. Everything is there because nobody had ever really flown the jet fully loaded. And so I had never, ever seen a JP233, which is our primary weapon. I'd never seen it on a jet until I think probably the November before the war started. I'd seen one in the bomb dump when we went to have a look at it, but I'd never seen that. We'd never flown with all the chaff and flares fully loaded. We'd never flown with the guns fully loaded. And of course, the weight, we'd never flown the jet at its maximum all-up weight until we got out into the Gulf, and suddenly we were doing all that for real. And I think that configuration, if I remember correctly, was only flown maybe once or twice by a couple of crews in the late 80s just to see what it was like. And so we'd never, ever flown the jet in a full wartime configuration until maybe a month or so before the war started.
Incredible. Yeah, just gives you a flavour of the task ahead of you before the air war started. Yeah. And what I'm going to do now is, as I said earlier, for those of you who've just joined, we have a competition running this evening. So the best question put to John is going to win a signed copy of the book that we're talking about this evening, Tornado in the Eye of the Storm. It's John's latest piece of work. And as I said earlier, it's a fantastic read. There's a couple of questions that have come in already. The first one is from Darren Judd, perhaps a name you might know, John. Hi, John. Having flown both the GR1 and the F3, apart from the obvious visual differences and roles, how did they compare to fly or operate?
Well, I mean, the whole point about it. Hi, Darren. How are you doing, mate? The whole point about it was that they were completely, the airframe was not dissimilar and the aircraft was not dissimilar, but the roles were totally and utterly incomparable. So a GR1 You are flying at ultra low level, attacking airfields, bridges, etc., etc., etc. The F3 was a fabulous. I loved being on the F3. It wasn't the best dogfighter in the world. It was more of an interceptor than anything else. I think most people would agree. But it was really good, and we gave a great account of ourselves on the big exercises in America, when we took the F3 out there. We gave a good account. You wouldn't want to get in a dogfight with an F16 or an F15 in an F3, don't get me wrong. But a package of eight F3s attacking a high-value asset like an AWACS or a tanker, we got through regularly. So they were completely different aircraft, completely different tactics, completely different jobs. It is like trying to compare a bricklayer and a plasterer. Mm-hmm. They both work on a building site and building houses, but they're completely different jobs. It's a good question, Darren, but as you did, you've been on them both, you can't possibly win the book, mate, I don't think.
Yeah. Okay, the next question is from Rachel Broxton. Hi, Rachel. John, you have had an amazing career with the Tornado. If there was one pilot from the past you could meet and speak with about aviation, who would it be?
Oh, well, that's a very good question, Rachel. I have been really, really lucky to meet some icons of aviation. So I spent a huge amount of my time with World War II pilots. You know, some of the greats from the Battle of Britain, some of the greats from the Dam Busters, some of the, you know, some of the really famous names from World War II. I also met, who landed his aircraft on the Hudson River?
Scully.
Sorry, Scully. Scully the him. Something Scully. Scully the third or something.
Yeah,
Somebody put a comment along the bottom.
Someone's going to write it on there. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And I met him in the RAF club a few years ago, and it really interesting talking to somebody like that. I think probably, and I've met some of the astronauts from the Apollo missions. Chuck Yeager, he would be good to meet. He would have been good to have a natter with. I sound a bit kind of fancy there because I've actually met loads of them and I've been privileged to chat to them. It's a very good question though, Rachel.
Yeah, well there you go. That's fine reward for a career in publishing, John. so let's get back to the Tornado story and your journey through the Gulf War, John. So you talked about the munitions, you spoke about the training and the tactics. Now, you said to me recently that whilst the Tornado was optimized for low level and its job was in the weeds, you know, providing its contribution to the conflict, it was known for this JP-233 munition. Tell us about that and tell us the irony about it actually having never been used in anger.
Well, so the JP-233 was the primary weapon that the Tornado was going to use in the first couple of days of the Cold War in Europe turning hot. It was basically a runway busting weapon. It was basically an airfield, we call it airfield denial. You're trying to deny the enemy the use of his airfield. And so a JP-233, that picture that we saw earlier on, two massive, great green suitcases under, they were massive, I think 5 tons the pair, something like that. They were huge. And they had in the cratering munitions. They had in each one, there's 30, so 60 per jet. And those cratering munitions would come out when you had to fly straight over either the runway or the taxiways or whatever. The cratering munitions would come out, go down on parachutes. An explosive charge would pump through the runway. The cratering munition would go down into the runway beneath the runway surface, and then it would explode. It would heave. It was called heaving. It would heave up the whole of the airfield surface. So instead of just dropping a bomb and putting a hole in it, you'd really be forced, as though somebody had gone in with a massive digger and pulled out huge big chunks. And so each jet would carry two JP-233, so 60 runway cratering munitions. I hope there's any QIs watching. I'm sure they're going to correct me on my figures here. And the back portion of the jet had sorry, the other portion of the jet had, sorry, of the JP-233 had 215 basically anti-personnel mines. So you would, while you pumped out 60 runway cratering munitions, you would also spray out 430 mines. Now, so if you then put 8 jets over an airfield, somebody else do the maths, 8 times 60, 8 times 430, that you're pumping out a huge amount of ordnance, you're destroying the runway surfaces, and you're sowing a minefield. So if anybody tries to come and repair it, they're going to get blown up and killed. Mm-hmm. And it was a very effective weapon in theory. It had two problems. It was designed for the Warsaw Pact airfields, which were built on a substrata of clay and soil, so that the charge would go through the runway, not go down too far, and it would blast the runway upwards. Nobody's really all that sure how well they operated, pumping down into desert and the sand actually absorbing the charge. And the other problem that you had with them, you had to fly over the airfield straight and level. And the minimum height was 180 feet. So at night, the guys on the first night were going in on TFR at 200 feet. Maybe 30 seconds before hitting the airfield, they'd trip out the TFR, and then they'd go down on either the Radalt or whatever at 180 feet over the airfield. But you had to fly straight and level till this whole thing came out. And so that was a bit of a shocker on the first night when the guys came up against the flak and the AAA, which they had not expected. But that's what it was. That's what we were designed to do. That's what we trained to do. And that's what the Tornado did for the first, three nights of the war.
Mm-hmm. Now, John, I remember, I think I was doing my GCSEs at the time. So I was distracted from my studies, as you might imagine. And I remember as a 15-year-old thinking, these guys are putting themselves in harm's way, low level, spearheading the attacks, you know, and certainly for the first few days of the war, you know, the Iraqi defences were essentially at least more intact than they were, you know, days beyond. So, and I remember in your book about how Schwarzkopf made a particular reference to the Tornado crew.
I don't know if that's me gone off, John, or you, but you've...
Can you hear me?
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I was just saying that, you know, Schwarzkopf, the overall commander of the coalition forces, made special mention of the Tornado Force and the pilots because of the missions you were flying. Give us a flavour, John, of you know, those you spoke to and your personal experiences about what it was like taking this aircraft to war. And what you were faced with?
I think there's two really important things, John. So as context, a lot of people at the time and in the aftermath were talking about the low-level operations and how it was just the Tornado that was doing it and how it was dangerous and should they really be doing this. And I think what everybody's got to remember is on the first two or three nights, the huge swathes of the Allied force were flying at low level. So all of the Tornadoes, the Saudis, the Italians, and the Brits were all at low level. All the Americans, like the A6s off the carriers, were all flying at low level. F-15E, the Strike Eagle, they were all at low level. There were two Strike Eagles lost in the first 48 hours, one of the most modern jets in the Allied infantry. Two were lost at low level in the first 48 hours, I think. The B-52s. So B-52s, what's the wingspan of a B-52? Somebody type it along the bottom for me. 180 feet, I think, something like that. B-52s were flying at 50 feet on the first nights going in towards their target. Wow. This misconception that only the GR-1s were flying at low level is completely and utterly wrong. So almost loads of the Strikers were flying at low level. Flying the Tornado at night was just... astonishing. So my first op was daytime, but in the book I talk about the guys who flew that first operation at night. So this is the first time the Tornado had ever been used in action. And I describe in the book, so there's 24 jets, so 8 from each of the three bases take off to attack their targets. And they're heading over the Saudi-Iraq border. 200 feet in the dead of night. So to all of the private pilots out there, this isn't night vision goggles. This isn't global positioning or anything. This is inertial navigation for navigation and terrain following radar sweeping the land ahead of you. And in layman's terms, looking for the rise in the sand dunes, looking for masts, looking for power lines. And you could set the GEO on to fly at 200 feet, hard ride, you would call it, because it had three different settings, and it would hold you at 200 feet, and it would bang, it would just go across the top of everything. So you would maintain 200 feet separation from whatever was beneath you.
And John, I have to say, sorry, I mean, going through my mind as a pilot, that must have required implicit trust in the technology. Yeah. And complete and utter trust of the guy in the front seat as well to make those judgments.
No, you didn't have to trust the guy in the front seat at all.
Because yeah. he's
monitoring the system. So if he's flying at 600 knots, he's got his hands, because it was all he then, completely different now, but it was all he then. He's got his hands on his lap, away from the controls. Mm. The controls are doing this between his legs, and the throttles are moving slightly to adjust the speed. The pilot's job on terrain following radar is to monitor what was called the terrain following scope, the e-scope, to make sure that the autopilot, which was being fed by the terrain following radar, was going to carry the jet over the top of anything. And he was monitoring that. So you had complete trust in that. You had to have trust in everybody else around you. You couldn't see them. So if you've got eight jets in parallel track, 1 or 2 miles spaced, all flying at 520, 550 miles an hour, all at 200 feet, a mile or 2 miles separated, depending on what the tactics were and who was doing it. It's black. It's not black where you can see something. It's a black cloak because nobody's got any lights on. And the desert's black apart from if you can see a town or an installation over there. And the jet is doing its own thing. And the jet next to you is doing its own thing. And the jet behind you is doing its own thing. And the jet behind them is doing its own thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is complete trust. And we had done it. We'd done it through the mountains of Scotland. We'd done it through the valleys in Canada. So we trusted the system implicitly, in actual fact. Mm.
So turning to the footnote of your book, In the Eye of the Storm, I'm just going to hold that up for our viewers and yourself. This picture here, I mean, it's an incredible photograph. With the accounts that you recorded from your colleagues, just let everybody understand what that was like to suddenly encounter this AAA and the defences that, you know, you knew were there, but you weren't quite sure what it was going to deliver.
We had no idea. So first of all, I flew during the first mission during the day, so we didn't quite see what they saw. But that first night, so we were ready for radar-guided missiles. We were ready for fighters to get off the ground. We had it. We were ready. What nobody fully understood was what good old-fashioned gunfire looked like, because you can't train against that. You'd never seen anything like it before. No. And so Rizza, Nigel Risdell, who led the first op from Bahrain with the squadron boss, JB, I use his kind of imagery in the book when I'm describing that first night. He said, so all the jets are in total darkness. You can't see anything. He said, everybody's flying along, TFR, 200 feet, heading through Iraq towards the target. And he said, you couldn't see anything. A gentle glow of the instruments, kind of 2 feet in front of you, the gentle glow of the head-up display, you couldn't see anything. You couldn't see the nose of the aircraft. He said that he said it's jet black. He said, I looked out into my left 10 o'clock and there was a pinprick of light out in the darkness. And he said, as we got closer, the pinprick of light started to evolve and it started to form. And he said, as we got even closer out in my left 10 o'clock, I could see that in actual fact, it was ground fire. And the fire was coming up in a circle around what he presumed was an airfield. And all of the guns on the airfield were firing into the air. And he said all of the fire intermeshed and was interwoven into what he said was it's like a sparkling Christmas tree. And he said, as you get even closer in his left, you can see all of this sparkling, all of this light, all of this interweaving. And it's a solid wall, a dome of light out there. And he said to John Broadbent, the squadron boss in the back, he said, bloody hell, somebody's getting hammered over there. And JB said, yes, mate, we're heading that way. And as he did that, the jets all turned left because they were all on autopilot. So the pilot's not doing it. They all turned left. And he said, we were pointing at this exploding wall of lead. And nobody had ever seen it. And if it was, the descriptions were unimaginable. And that picture that you showed, that was a fraction of what it was like over the airfields, where you might have 500, 1,000 guns, and then another 500,000 soldiers on the ground just firing AK-47s, spraying them into the air with tracer, everything glowing, everything swirling. And you couldn't do anything about it. You just had to fly into this cauldron of fire and hope that you made it out the other side.
Yeah. Well, I read a number of accounts in the book, John, from those that you spoke with. And, one of the things that really stood out for me was how you prepare yourself for the unknown. So obviously, we've sort of fast forwarded slightly where, okay, you've now encountered the enemy. You've now had this realization of what, going to war really looks like. But, prior to those initial missions, there must have been tremendous, a mixture of excitement because you trained for this. Some people probably wanted to bring it on. Others were probably fearful, maybe the people that had family back home who had children. And you can flip it on its head perhaps as well. And I like what's said in the book as well, where, you've actually done one mission, so you now know what to expect.
I only did one mission.
Yes, well, of course. But can you just give us a flavour of how your colleagues dealt with the whole anxiety and fear of going to war?
I think it was a double-edged sword. So first of all, you definitely want a copper doesn't want to run into a pub in the middle of a riot, but that's his job and that's what you're trying to do, and you want to see if you can do it. A firefighter's the same, a paramedic's the same, and I know I've used the analogy before. So there was a double-edged sword. So you wanted to do it. You wanted to prove that you could do it. You wanted to do it because your mates were doing it and you didn't want to let anybody down. And it was exciting. Don't get me wrong. It was exciting. People were being given the chance to do the job they trained to. And at the back of the mind, there was absolutely and utterly the very real notion that you could die. And as more jets were lost, as kind of day one, day two, day three, day four happened, that certainly became to take hold, not for everybody and not across the force, and people were affected in different ways, but it became apparent, speaking to especially some of the senior leaders, that some people were feeling the strain, some people were wondering what might happen, and some people weren't sure if they'd survive. But it's what you train to do, and so nobody was going to be saying, I'm not doing this anymore, although, as I detail in the book, a couple of people were taken off operations in actual fact because of the strains of what they were going through.
Yeah, of course. I'm just going to hit the pause button once again. There's a couple more questions that have come in. I'm just going to scroll up here. One from Kev, our blaster. Kev is one of our air ability flyers. Hi, Kev. He says, John, did the Tornado and Buccaneer work together in the first Gulf War?
Yes, very good question, Kev. Good to see you, mate. I tell the story in detail in the book, but the Buccaneers were not there at the beginning, although they were ready to go. They'd been told they would not be required. Because we were not going to be using laser-guided bombs. And if we did, the Americans would provide the support for it. But in actual fact, after, I think, 4 or 5 days, it became apparent that the Tornadoes were not going to operate at low level for the whole of the conflict, and we would need to start using laser-guided weaponry. Very few people on the force had ever done it before, but the Buccaneers were there. They deployed, I think, within 24 hours of being warned that they'd be going out there from Lossiemouth. They were, you know, they were ready and they were flying out to the Gulf, and with they started training with the Tornadoes immediately. And the first, I can't remember when exactly when the first laser guided bombs were dropped, but it was quite quickly. And so they did work together, but for some people had, so basically anybody who'd done the QI course, the Qualified Weapons Instructors course, they had done laser guided bombs. So one of the squadrons, 20 squadron, had a laser guided role if the Cold War had ever turned hot. So they had a bit of experience. But very few people had any experience of dropping laser-guided bombs. Very few.
Mm-hmm. Good question, Kev. Andy Owen has just said the chap who landed the Airbus on the Hudson was Chester Sully Sullenberger.
Sully Sullenberger the third. Sully Sullenberger. Yeah.
Okay, Phil Wilson says, have you considered a general aviation novel in the same style, but with, say, a chapter on each type, starting from glider to Concorde, as previously focused on personal stories and frights? That's a good one.
Phil, if you mean a novel, I don't think you could write a work of fiction. I don't think you could write a general aviation novel from glider to Concorde. I'm unsure how you would flow with that, if I'm brutally honest. You could write a general aviation book, a factual book on it, but there's a load of them, and that's not what I write. I look at a narrow subject and get people to tell me their story. So the best way to explain how I work is that everybody said, what book are you doing next? And everybody, you must do the mosquito. You've got to do the mosquito next, or you must do the hurricane. And I can't, because there are not the mosquito veterans with the death stories. I think there's probably half a dozen or something that I know of who are still alive. And it's the same with the hurricane. There's not veterans there who can now tell me their stories. And so, unfortunately, I won't do another World War II book for some time.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be able to, so I couldn't do a From the Glider to Concorde type book. That's not for me.
Yeah. Phil asks another question, but do you know what? I'm going to save that question until the end. So, John, remind me, there's another one from Phil that I need to ask you, because it's, I'm going to time
an asterisk. He's got an asterisk next to his name.
Yeah. okay, let's go back to the book, John. So, you know, we've spoken about going into the eye of the storm and what those experiences were like and what the aircraft was used or utilized for. Now, you explain very well and very compassionately about those that didn't return, John. Some of you were fortunate in that you didn't lose your lives, and there were those that did. And John, my question to you with the you know, the jeopardy of war comes risk, and for you that ended on your first mission. Some of us have read the book, we've seen the documentary. John, we know your name because of your experiences in the Gulf. Mm-hmm. Can you just tell us what happened with you and your pilot?
Yeah, so John Peters and I were the first daylight attack of Desert Storm. And if I remember correctly, I think probably the last daylight tornado low-level attack as well, in actual fact. I don't think the recce jets were still doing low-level, but I don't think anybody else did any airfield attacks in a tornado during the daylight. Myself, we were armed with 8 1,000-pound bombs, and we were going into an attack Al Ramalia Southwest Airfield, which was over towards Basra. Daylight, so JP, my pilot's flying in kind of 30 feet. In the midst of the attack, the weapons don't come off the aircraft. Almost certainly my mistake, button pressing, and not getting a button pressing sequence in order. So the attack fails, which is devastating for both of us, but there's nothing that we can do about it, despite a kind of a two-second notion that we might try and go around and do this again, although we didn't. You know, we mulled that over for about half a second. And so we're actually exiting the target area, and you know, kind of some Air Force folklore has those different versions of this, but what actually happened is probably, I think we were probably maybe a minute off the target. We dumped the bombs, we got rid of them, and we were heading back in the route, heading back towards the exit gate to get out of the area safely. And we think that we're safe. So we think that we're on our way home. Now, we're beating the crap out of ourselves, seeing, oh, my, why did that attack arise? And oh, I think, you know, I did this, I think this did this wrong. So we're talking about what went wrong. In very, you know, I mean, this isn't going on for a minute. This is kind of, oh, my God, what went wrong type thing. But so we're mulling over what people will say about our actions when we get home, because we failed, or I had failed, on the very first mission of the war, which is not what you want to, that's not what you want to do. But we were hit from nowhere. We didn't see it coming. This was the days before missile warners for heat-seeking missiles. We had radar missile warners, but not heat-seeking missile warners. So we didn't see it coming. Heat-seeking missile hit us from kind of the right 5 o'clock, just straight into the right-hand side of the jet. And so JP's flying kind of 30 feet-ish, 600 miles an hour, something like that. And it's the jet is just, it's just like being hit by an express train. It was, and the jet almost kind of flips. And it's kind of, it's still flying, but it's almost, it's not quite, it's flying kind of sideways-ish. And whereas we've been looking up at blue sky, I was looking up, and I was looking up now at brown sand. At least I'm presuming that sand that was brown at that particular moment. And the, basically the jet's wallowing, and luckily, with supreme piloting skills, JP gets, manages to get the aircraft back under control, rights it. Now, all of the fly-by-wire stuff's down. So everything, if the people who know the Tornado, it's now in what's called mechanical mode. So every piece of electronic flying equipment is gone. And you're basically, the all of the control surfaces are now redundant. All you've got two metal rods. I'm just kind of paraphrasing here. You've got two metal rods that go from the pilot's control column to the tailerons at the back. And it becomes a real bloody bucking Bronco at 30 feet. So we're in mech mode. The right-hand engine's on fire. There's a, it's basically we're in the midst of a catastrophic failure. We head out of the stream, which you're not meant to do, but there was, we head out and head straight south, the shortest route to the border, hoping that we will get to the border. But it wasn't going to happen. So if you've ever been in a tornado, you've got rear view mirrors. Same as you've got in a car. I don't know, do you have rear view mirrors in civvy light aircraft? Mm-hmm. You've got rear view mirrors. Back of a Tornado with its tailerons. Oh, well, you can kind of see how big it is there. It's a big old unit. And I looked in my rear view mirror and there was nothing there. The aircraft had gone. And it was basically a ball of flame. And it was a ball of flame marching to where I sit in the rear seat. Now, we know that we're on fire. JP's going through the drills because we've got right-hand engine fire. We've got all sorts of different fire warnings, all sorts of different failures. And so I say to JP, JP, we're on fire. And he says, I effing know we're on fire. And I said, no, mate, look in the mirror. And so he looked up from trying to sort all these other, and we're just flying a freaking inferno. I mean, it's like a comet. And, you know, you're in real danger of just kind of exploding there. Now, you might have 5 seconds. It could go on for another 3 or 4 minutes. We could get close at the border, but we said, right, we've got to eject. So he pulled up, and I think we ejected it probably, I don't know, I think probably 200, 300 feet, something like that. I put out a broadcast to tell AWACS that we were coming out, although apparently nobody heard it, and broadcast our position, reference a code point. And then we just pulled the handles and started the ride.
Mm. Now, one of the things that I would assume happened thereafter was falling back on your training. And clearly, you know, you found yourself in this position. You know, you've only got one choice. And then what happened next? I mean, clearly you both survived the ejection.
Yeah, I mean, listen, the Martin Baker seat, you know, saved, what's it? I think it's up to, I checked the website earlier on, 7,500 lives the Martin Baker seat has saved since it first came into service. And obviously there's loads of other seats around the world. Mm-hmm. And it worked exactly as planned. And from pulling the handle to being in the parachute, I think probably on the Mark 10 seat, I think it's a second and a half, something like that. And then because we were solo, I think I was probably in the parachute for just a matter of seconds, just enough to kind of look down, think, crap. I saw the jet flying off over there and hit the ground and explode in a massive big cloud of black smoke. I thought somebody's going to see that, hit the ground. And yes, we were trained, but I have to say that the physicality of standing up in the desert, getting your parachute harness off and kind of trying to get yourself together was just, I want to say overwhelming, but it's not overwhelming because you know what you have to do. It's almost surreal. It's almost unreal. And so I could see JP, I ran over to him and we started laughing. And I said, we're in Iraq. Can you believe it? We're in effing Iraq. Mm. 7 hours earlier, we'd been in the flipping Sheraton Hotel, waking up in a lovely luxury room type thing. And yeah, we were in Iraq on the first day of the war. And that was a bit of a freaking shocker. Not much you can do. With the search and rescue points, there's some SF teams in the desert. We had a couple of positions. Rescue missions could have been mounted. Unlikely during the day, but if we could hide, and some people did get rescued. So we set off on the run to a search and rescue point. It would have been a marathon. I think it was about 20 miles away, but we could have done that. But the people that had shot us down knew that they'd hit us. They'd seen the aircraft explode. And so after about, I can't remember, maybe 3 hours, kind of shots started to ring out. And real, you know, have you ever played Call of Duty? If you're younger, if you've played Call of Duty, mm. or if you're yeah. older and you watched cowboy films in the 60s and the 70s with your mum and dad on a Sunday afternoon, it was that kind of bullets whizzing past your ears. The cowboy movies, when the tufts of sand would be kind of blown up and the cactus plant would be torn apart, that's kind of what it's like with the bullets whizzing past your ears. And so after a bit of basic discussion about kind of what we're going to do now type thing, we're kind of, you know, we did consider having a bit of a shootout, and basically the Americans would call it suicide by cop, in that, you know, we thought we don't want to be captured. So let's go and charge at them, try and kill some of them with our pathetic little Walthers that we carried before we're killed ourselves. But clearly we didn't, because I'm still here. And we were captured and dragged off to Baghdad. And that's when the adventure started for us. And obviously we were out of the war then and had no concept about what was going on. We had no concept about what our mates were doing. We had no concept about who survived and who died. We had no concept about, you know, we fully expected Iraq to be using chemical weapons. We didn't know anything about the ground war. We basically, or I sat on my fat backside for 7 weeks.
Mm-hmm. And John, vividly, you describe in the book the experiences of not just yourself and John Peters, but your colleagues as well, who went through the same experiences. And it's in the book for people to read and to make their own conclusions. But, you know, how did you keep a lid on it, I think, is the question I've got, John. How did you, I mean, there's always hope. And I remember you saying that in the book, that John Peters said to you. But, you know, you're in a position where you're completely out of control of your mm-hmm. destiny. What did you fall back on? I mean, your faith, your hope. I mean, how did it work?
It's a question, John, that everybody asks. How did you get through it? What did you fall back on? What did you hold on to? And I would turn that around and say, what could I have done differently? You couldn't commit suicide. So that's, I suppose, that is the one way perhaps that you could, you know, if you could have found some way of killing yourself, and there was no way, you were in a concrete cell with nothing. So you couldn't do that. So I didn't fall back on anything, mostly. I didn't hold on to anything, mostly. I existed, and all of the other prisoners of war existed. And in the book, some of the brutality is astonishing. Some of the brutality is toe-curlingly awful, that, you know, and it is really bad. What happened to some of us was, and especially to some of the guys that were injured, was really, really bad. But what could you do about it? You couldn't do anything about it. You just had to exist. You were either going to die if they killed you, or you were not going to die. And then you just have to wait for the next session or the next day or the next brutality. So I didn't really cope with it in that way. I existed whilst it happened. Yes, there was. You always kind of see yourself, well, there's always hope. You know, it might be over. I didn't think it would be over in 7 weeks. 7 years was something that I thought it might go on for, quite seriously. You know, the Iran-Iraq war went on for 10 years. Vietnam, what was that, 7 years? The Second World War, some of the prisoners of war there from the beginning. So I never thought it would be over in 7 weeks at all, not even slightly. So you're just existing, and you have no other choice but to exist in the midst of adversity. Yeah. And so obviously, you know, they're the pictures of myself and John Peters that were flashed around the world when we were kind of, you know, forced at gunpoint and under threat of execution to appear on TV.
And back to your asterisk against Phil Wilson. This question is now relevant. He says, did you provide any feedback to the Royal Air Force training based on your post-ejection escape and evade and enemy capture? And I had that question as well in my armory ready for later. So, I mean, I'm assuming that there was great interest in your experiences and you probably were able to contribute a lot.
There was. That's a very good question, Phil. There was on every level. So everything from, you know, the command structure and how things were formed, everybody was learning everything. And so simple, really simple, stupid things. So, for instance, when we came out of the aircraft, you're coming out with your survival pack, and your survival pack's got stuff in it, and it's in your seat, it's in your seat pack, and it comes down in your yellow seat box. It's got stuff, it's got some of your survival equipment in there and everything else, but it is sealed, semi-sealed into this box that nobody had ever told us how to get into the box. Because the box also had your survival dinghy in it. And the notion was you just pull the handle, activate your dinghy, because that's just what you would do. And that's what you always train to do. And all the different drills, that's what you train to do. And so we're looking at these plastic boxes, thinking, how the hell do we get in here to get to the water, to get to the little bits and pieces that are in our survival packs? And so we didn't know. And so I basically pulled a handle, and we're in the middle of the bloody desert. And a great big orange, Dayglo orange dinghy inflates in the bloody desert. And that was something that then went back, and everybody's right. It's really simple. All you've got to do is undo these straps and flip this, and that's it. But no, we didn't know. Things about what would happen to prisoners of war changed. The whole concept, and I don't want to say too much about it, the whole concept of resistance to interrogation changed. In the light of what happened to us, and many of my friends really didn't like me, because then everybody had to go on to new combat survival courses and interrogation courses in the light of what had happened to us. Things did definitely change.
Okay, just going through some more of these questions. I think there's a real appetite here, John, to get that signed book. Patricia Amos asks, when you ejected from the tornado, what height do you get ejected to?
The tornado's got a Mark 10 ejection seat, and it is called a 0-0 seat. And basically what that means is if you are on the ground, on the end of the runway, and the jet catches fire, you're not moving, you're on the ground, you can eject, and the seat will fire you high enough for the parachute to deploy, for you to come out of the seat, and for you to land relatively safely. I can't remember the exact height, but if you're on the ground, I think it would shoot you 180 feet into the air. And so that's how high it takes you out. So if you're at 300 feet, it shoots you out of the aircraft to 180 feet above that. But it's a 0-0 seat, so it's designed in the worst case scenario to be used on the ground, stationary. Amazing, amazing piece of technology.
Yeah. Okay, a couple more questions and then we'll return. The next question is it's a question, it's a very, very good point. And this is one of the Air Ability trustees, actually, John, a chap by the name of Neil Tucker, who has an acquired disability through a traumatic event that occurred in his life. He makes a very good point there, you know, and this you can see it on the screen, and this sort of points to the aftermath that it you know, PTSD, which perhaps wasn't as prolific or as well understood, or at least you know, been made aware of in during the period that you experienced your traumatic event. Mm-hmm. Tell us a bit about how the support network mobilized to support those like yourselves who'd been through this event. And in the book, you talk about a psychiatrist, Gordon Turnbull, who I think sounds like a, you know, an incredible individual. But tell us about some of the events after the fact.
It's a really good question, Neil, an excellent question. So the military in the past had been pretty poor in its recognition of trauma. As you rightly say, a physical injury can be seen. A physical, you know, if you've lost a leg, you can see that somebody has lost a leg. If you have a trauma of the, I'm going to say the mind rather than the brain, if so, then it can't be seen. And unless you understand what it means and what the symptoms are, it can cause you serious problems, which of course is what post-traumatic stress disorder was. So when we were released, Gordon Turnbull, an RAF psychiatrist who'd actually been involved at the Lockerbie air disaster when the Pan Am, I think, aircraft crashed over Lockerbie. He'd been involved there with the RAF mountain rescue crews and the Chinook crews that were doing the rescue. And he recognized post-traumatic stress in quite a few of those people. And he fought the RAF authorities in a big way to ensure that we, the prisoners of war, were not allowed to simply go back straight away, join our families, get hammered, have a curry, and think it was all over, because that's what we wanted to do. Don't get me wrong. And he held us prisoner in Cyprus, and we railed against this. And I talk about it in the book. I was not happy with this at all. I did not want any part of this. I thought it was nonsense. But he was absolutely right, because we all, in various ways, needed to understand what we'd gone through, how we might feel about it. And it was really important. Now, the caveat to that is, I would say, so he did that for the 7 RAF prisoners of war and I can't remember how many special forces SAS guys they were. Obviously, one or two are well known. There was quite a few others that have never been heard of. So there was, let's just say, there was about 14 or 15 of us. But there was another 45,000 British service personnel, some of whom had seen some horrific things, horrific things. But we were lucky we got care, and I thank Gordon to this day and have done only recently when I was chatting to him, because it was absolutely the right thing to do. Good question. Yeah.
Now, part of that decompression was spending time, as you say, before. You know where we know where I'm going with this, don't you?
I do. Your
time at Akrotiri. So tell us about Rupert Clark's escape committee.
So we were, as I say, we wanted to go home. But we were flown to Cyprus to the military hospital, and they were really good. They were great. But we were there for, I think, 3 days. And I think that after day one, some of us were getting a bit bored. And so Roops and I decided we were going to organize the first prisoner of war escape since, I don't know what, Korea, I suppose, something like the Falklands, maybe. And we got everybody together, and we persuaded one of the medics, I think he got into fearful trouble in the end, to, during a towards the end of the day, to drive us over to the officer's mess. And we managed to get one of the SAS guys who'd been really badly shot up. We managed to get him in the lift, unseen, in his bed, down onto the bottom floor to get out of Cyprus. I think it was the bottom floor. But he was then in too much pain. So we had to take him back. This was like something from World War II. We had to take him back up. And then all of the RAF guys, we all had a minder with us, so everybody had been allocated a friend to come and look after them, to be by their side, one of our squadron friends. So we all got in this minibus and headed off to the bar. And it was one of the most joyous, moving, fabulous occasions. I feel quite emotional now of my life, because the bar was packed, because Cyprus was the hub of operations. People were coming and going. There must have been, I don't know, 200 people in there or something, because, you know, 7 o'clock at night in Cyprus, in the middle of a massive operation with jets going back and forwards. And we went in there, and they kind of, the cheering went up, and you know, we never bought a drink, and we were drinking. We said we'd only go for one quiet beer, which we did. We had one quiet beer, but then we had 10 really loud beers after that. And whilst we were enjoying those 10 really loud beers, the crap hit the fan in the hospital because there was still an ongoing terrorist threat. And we'd escaped, and nobody knew where we were. And so the search parties went out. Nobody thought, I know what we'll do. We'll whiz over to the other side of the station and see if they're in the officer's mess bar. But we got back, and they couldn't really do much to us. But the guys we were with, our minders, got into fearful trouble and got some industrial bollockings. And I remember this in one of the, I think it was Nick Hurd, who was there to look after Rupert. Nick said, so the most senior medical officer was giving him an industrial-sized bollocking about how he was in fearful trouble. And Nick was just thinking, do you know what? I was nearly killed 8 nights ago flying on operations over Iraq. I'm going to be fine. If you can bollock me all you like. We had a great night, but I was slightly ashamed at all of the trouble that we caused.
Well, it's a really good part of the book. And talking about this emotional roller coaster, John, as a reader, one of the things that at least I felt profoundly moved by, John, was your account about those that didn't come home and their families. You know, you talk about the experiences of the POWs meeting up with their families for the first time and what that meant, but also how the war widows, the ladies challenged the what seems to be an archaic set of rules that hadn't had the opportunity to be aired for a very long time. Can you tell us a bit about the aftermath, John, and those that didn't come back and those that did?
Yeah, it was a tough old time coming home. Clearly, you know, our families were delighted to see us. Nobody knew who'd survived, who was survived or had been killed until the very end. The Iraqis hadn't released any information. And people like Rupert Clark were presumed to be dead. Everybody presumed he was dead. And so when Nick Hurd in the book says, when Rupert walked off the aircraft, they couldn't believe it. They just presumed he was dead. But Rupert's nav, Steve Hicks, a friend of mine, had been killed in the attack. And we were flying back to, in our case, Larbrook, to our base in Larbrook. And we were, my mum and dad and brother had been flown out to Larbrook. We were in the mess drinking. Everybody was there. You know, people came from around the station. There was a huge party on the, I think it was the Sunday afternoon when we flew back in. And yet within, and some of the people who went home, so Nick Hurd went back to his wife in the married quarters, half a dozen doors down, people were being told that their husbands weren't coming home. And that contrast was quite, quite difficult. I mean, you know, that was, you know, for the wives, and it was obviously all wives then, being told that your husband's not coming home, for a child to be told your dad's not coming home. That was really tough. And I cover some of it in the book. And then they had all of the other things to contend with. So Jenny Green, one of the, her husband was killed before the war started. He was actually a group captain, although he was still OC 27 squadron. He was killed in a flying accident training, preparing to go out. He was killed. And she talks about her experiences in the aftermath. So she said she felt like, as though she was a leper, unwanted. Now, nobody set out to be mean, but the military had to move on. They needed her married quarter back because a new boss was coming in to take over the squadron. She had to move out of her married quarter very, very quickly. She felt, you know, she had her station pass taken away very quickly, so she couldn't go onto base. She stopped receiving invitations to go to the little drinks parties and everything else. Not because anybody was being mean or nasty. It was just everybody had to move on really quickly. And then her fight for the rights of widows started in earnest at the end of the war, when there was quite a few RAF widows. And she decided to use her experience to change the system, which she did. Simple things. like kind of, you know, you don't have to move straight out of your marriage quarter. A pack of information to see this is what will happen to you. A pack of information to see these are your entitlements. One of the most egregious ones in my, it sounds quite pathetic now, but it was egregious that I think. So if your husband was killed, you would have a war pension and his military pension. But what you could not then do is remarry, because the system said the little lady, and I use that inverted commas before any, the little lady, if she remarries, has got a new man to look after her. So she doesn't need her husband's pension that he earned, that he died for. And you would lose it. If you wanted to remarry, you lost your war widow's pension, you lost your military pension. And she changed that. She fought, and I think fought for probably 15 years, I think it was, to get that change. So there was a lot of changes came about in the aftermath of that conflict.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, a silver lining, perhaps. But the question I'm looking at here from Andy Owen is a good one. I'm just going to return to a couple of questions here. And I do recall, John, a documentary of when you returned to Iraq. And it says here, after the war, did you go back to Iraq and maybe meet with those who captured you and looked after you in the prison? It's an interesting choice of words there, Andy. I do seem to recall you did something on this, John, didn't you? And what on earth was that like?
I really, you know, I went back in 2000, so to 9 years after the war, to make a documentary for the BBC, for BBC Breakfast, about the war 10 years on. So it went out in 2001. I think it was amazing. The Iraqi people, for them, this was still obviously under Saddam Hussein's evil dictatorship then. Although I would suggest it was probably safer for me then than it would be to try and go now, to be perfectly honest. But that's another long story. They were, on the most part, really friendly, really polite, really pleased to see me. I went back down to the airfield near where we'd been shot down, found an Iraqi pilot who'd been shot down himself. And he'd obviously, so back in the back 9 years before, he would have been trying to kill me while I was trying to kill him. We went out for lunch. He was so hospitable. He took us, everybody, the film crew and everyone, out for lunch and sat. Classic hospitality of the region, 3 or 4 hours in a restaurant, lunch. I went back to the prison where I was held with some of the military guards, not the hideous place. So I was in the secret police, the Mukhabarat headquarters. That was awful. Didn't go there. And Abu Ghraib, which became notorious after the Americans took over. I didn't go back there either. But I went back to, and I went back into the cell where I'd been held for, I think it was probably only a week or something at the beginning. And I found it enlightening and emotional, because they were so lovely, so pleased to see me. And the horror was, the terrible was that 3 years later, in the midst of obviously the second Gulf War, again, a completely different conversation, obviously, it changed completely for all of them. And their world, you know, changed completely. And for the most part, they were really good, honest, decent, reasonable human beings. Good question, Andy.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's move to what I think, yet again, John, you took me on an emotional roller coaster in the book, and a lot of us flyers have it in the blood, running through our blood. And that was, you know, the tornado itself, the aircraft that looked after you during that traumatic event that you had, and many other crews. It served with distinction in the Royal Air Force, but, you know, all good things come to an end. And you talk wonderfully in the book about an event that occurred that the then Chief of the Air Staff, Sir Stephen Hillier, hosted and made a speech about the tornado force in terms of, you know, the aircraft itself, but also the people. Just tell us about that day.
It was a great day. So that was back in 2019, I think, the final disbandment of the tornado at Marham. And it was a fantastic, a really emotional parade. And then it was really, I think that if you've ever been in the military, you kind of understand. It was just being back in kind of a brotherhood stroke sisterhood with everybody, seeing old mates again. So there was the parade, then everybody went back to the officers' mess bar for a few beers, then everybody disappeared, got ready for the formal dinner in the evening in the massive hangar. So Sir Stephen spoke, the defense secretary spoke. I can't remember, you know, there's some other kind of quite a few other important people there, but most of it was just about this kind of celebration of friendship, the aircraft itself, because by then the aircraft had been on ops for, God, 30 years, nearly continuously in actual fact, nearly continuously. And it was really interesting. So I think the boss of, I think I've got this right, the boss of 9 Squadron was then Wing Commander James Heaps. And I was chatting to James, and he was telling me he'd been a young boy, a schoolboy, watching this unfold, and he'd been inspired to join the Royal Air Force because of the war. And then, and so when people say that, you think, oh, my God, that just makes me feel old. And then something even worse happened. I was introduced to a young pilot who had dropped some of the last bombs from the tornado over Syria and Iraq on that operation before it had flown back in the January, I think, of 2019. And I was chatting to him, and it transpired that when I – so he finished the war in the tornado in 2019. When we had gone to war in 1991 – he had not been born. And that is when you realize the length of time of the tornado in service and how old you're getting. Yes. He had not been born when we had gone to war. And that's quite interesting to think about it in those terms.
Yeah. Incredible. Right, last question goes to me. And I, if you think it's the best one, please don't give me the book.
it won't be.
I'm going to leave you to make the decision on the best question. The last question for me is, this must have been, an incredible experience for you putting this book together. And I think you touched on it earlier on. You know, you learnt about experiences from your friends that perhaps you'd never really spoken about over the last 30 years. Tell us about the personal experience, John, of you putting this book together.
It really was. It was absolutely revelatory to speak to. So speaking to mates, so people like Robbie Stewart and Dean Wadden, who were prisoners of war with me, who I'd known for 30 years. I had not fully understood what their war had been. People like my mates who'd continue to fly, people like Dave Bellamy, who's in the book, who flew with Trevor Roach, who I think you knew. So talking to Dave Bellamy, who was my flatmate. I lived with Belly. In a flat in Holland, and we were both based at Larbrook. I didn't know what Belly's war had been like. We never discussed it, ever. So that was intense. Speaking to the wives of those who were there, so especially the POW wives, of what they had gone through when their husbands were missing, if they didn't know if they were alive or dead. I had no concept. And for me, some of the most moving stuff was speaking to some of the children about what they'd gone through. So they were teenagers. So Bob Agson's son, Gareth, I think was 11 or 12. Robbie Stewart's daughter was 13. Bill Green's son was 17. They were kids. And to see the war through their eyes, I was in tears. They were in tears. I was in tears. I had to go through it. There's probably 25 main characters in the book. I had to do it for every bloody character. They only had to do it with me once when we all ended up descending into tears. I did this with every damn person. So it was really, really emotional. But for me, it was a revelation. And especially, I won't spoil it, but the last section with Jeremy Green and how the war, 30 years after the war, still is so very real in his life and in his children's life. And they never met their grandfather. You know, Bill's grandchildren never met him. But you have to read the book to understand what I mean. I was astonished about how the ripples from that war still roll through on a personal sense.
Yeah. And John, you know, what an endeavor you've taken on, and it's so nice to see it. It must be very pleasing for you just to see the success of this book, and you know, it clearly has earned its place as a bestseller This is a great point in our chat this evening, John, to just talk about the second career, which is a publishing career. What have you always had an interest in telling stories? And how did this evolve? I mean, clearly it evolved from your career in the Royal Air Force. I remember seeing you on the TV.
It came out by accident. You know, when we came back, people wanted to know the story. We wrote, John Peters and I wrote Tornado Down. Then we wrote another book called Team Tornado, just about life in the Air Force. I never thought much more about it. But then when I left the Air Force in 1996, I then wrote kind of another five novels. And then looking for something to do, because I didn't have a job, I thought, I might try this writing lark. And that's how it came about. And so I just look for stories to tell that excite and interest me. And whether that's about the Spitfire, the Spitfire or the Lancaster or the Tornado, I look for stories that excite and interest me. And that's what I'll continue to do until somebody tells me nobody's interested anymore, John.
Well, I can tell you for something, as an aviator and as an aviation enthusiast, but frankly, anyone who chooses to pick this book up, I can guarantee they won't be able to put it down. And a great piece of work, John. Tell us about the titles we can see behind you, in particular Lancaster and Spitfire. What was the stories with those two?
Where's Lancaster? There. That was basically the story of the Lancaster through the eyes of the people that flew it, as is the Spitfire one in actual fact. So some people kind of said, oh, it's not really the story of the Spitfire or the Lancaster. And I said, well, that's true. It's about through the eyes of the people that flew it. If you want another nuts and bolts story of the Spitfire, go on Amazon. There's about 1,000.
Yeah.
You can't tell anybody anything new about the Spitfire. It's just not possible. What I did, I tell the story through the people who flew it, built it, designed it, so that you get a personal story. And that's what Tornado is. It's a personal story of the aircraft through the eyes of people that operated it. And I've always done that, and I'll continue to do that.
Mm-hmm. So the obvious question, again, I'm sure you're asked all the time, what's bubbling up with the next project?
Well, it's already underway, but it's not going to be out. So Spitfire and Lancaster, I did a year apart. So Spitfire, Lancaster, Tornado, I've done every year. And that's been a real bloody pressure, doing a book a year, because that's quite it's quite a process. So I'm going to do 2 years to do the next one. So I've started already. It's a secret, and I can't tell you. But as I said, I can't do another World War II book. I'm not going to do stuff like the Harrier or the, because that's well done already. I'm not going to do the Vulcan, because that's done already. I'm going to do something different.
Okay. Well, you've heard it here. John, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you this evening. And, I'm sure you've told this story over many times, but finally, people can buy a book instead of asking you all the questions.
No, it's fine. And John, I mean, seriously, John, it's been great. You know, it's really good to have somebody who knows the stuff and kind of is knowledgeable. So, you know, it's been great chatting to you about it. It's not an interview, it's a chat. And obviously Harvey in the background, who's arranged it all and kind of persuaded me to come and do this for you. It's been a delight to do it. I've done little bits with Air Ability years ago, but it's always just about giving a signed book for one of your auctions. So to do this with you guys, so thanks Harvey in the background there. Thanks to you. I've really enjoyed it. Maybe I'll see you at some sort of an event in real life.
We've already heard that you like a drink, and there's no better place to have a few drinks aplenty, which is the Aviator's Ball, which we do in November, the end of November. So there you go. There's the invitation. So we can share a drink then, John. But there's one last thing I need to do, of course, which is to figure out from your perspective which was the best question of the evening.
There's some really good questions, some quite ones that I haven't been asked before, but I think for the most The one that, for me, is quite a personal one, it was Neil, I think it's Neil Tucker.
Neil Tucker.
Asking about kind of the traumatic events, how that affects you and how that continues to affect you. So I think that, Neil, excellent question, my friend. You in the signed book, if that's okay.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm sure he's going to light up the chat in just a second. So I would normally say that Neil can contact the front desk at AirAbility, but he actually sits at the front desk.
Have I chosen somebody? That sounds like a bit of a fix. No, that's fine.
No, not at all. No, not at all. He's always full of good questions. but John, look, once again, thank you very much for joining us this evening. As I've said to everybody listening right now, you know, you can download these as podcasts. Please tell your friends, send this far and wide, because, you know, I do feel a genuine affinity with you, John, and what AirAbility stands for. You know, it's about celebrating the ability in people and looking, you know, looking beyond the adversity and seeing what really the human spirit can achieve. And it's been a real privilege to talk to you this evening, John. So from myself and all of those listening this evening, thank you very much.